Hello, this is Janet Gallen, welcoming you to Love Letters Live with, yes, of course, another wonderful guest, a really interesting woman I met, what, a minute and 42 seconds ago?
Yeah, just about. Maybe
yes, and I'm already so taken with everything she has said. She's an actor and a model, and I wish for a television moment because people are going to have to hear it in your voice instead of seeing this beautiful face. Talk about you.
Well, I immigrated to the United States as a child with my immediate family, my biological mother and my stepfather and my siblings.
And how did that move come from South Africa to here?
Oh, my goodness. It was so rough. It was so crazy and hectic. And my stepfather moved here first, and he hadn't even planned on coming to the United States and staying here. He was on a contract where he worked with computers, but he told my mom all the stories about America, and the rose-colored lenses went on. And she said, you know, I want to move there. And so she had him bring us over. And it was heck in a handbasket trying to get here. We lost my brother in one of the airports.
Oh, my goodness. How old is he? A younger?
He's about 5 years older than me.
Uh-huh.
So at the time that we were moving...
So he was like a young teen.
Yeah, he was a young teen. And he couldn't keep awake in one part of the airports. And he went and snoozed on a bench. And my mom got up and rushed to the gate. And he went, where is he? He's gone. Uh-huh. So we luckily had a very nice gentleman who had found him.
And, really?
And brought him back to us and reconnected us so that we could all get on our flight together. So that was good.
So it was details like this that were difficult? I mean, you didn't flee for any reason.
Oh, no. The main reason that we decided to move to the Americas was safety. That was one of the main issues. In South Africa, during the time that I was growing up, was around the time of the end of the apartheid. So this was around the time that Nelson Mandela... was elected president in the early 90s, and he had enacted so many changes that a lot of people weren't really open to. There was a lot of people who were still stuck in that mindset of, I'm better than you because of the color of my skin, and that's it. It was literally black or white, and there was no in between. And we lived in a society where if you did not feel the same way as everybody else, you were targeted just as much
as the
oppressed people.
Sure.
And so we didn't want to live in a society that perceived individuals differently.
So you had to either stifle yourself or put yourself in danger.
Exactly.
It's terrible.
And so we made the move, and it was wonderful. It was quite a social shock. Schooling is very different here. Wow. A lot of the social infrastructure is very different.
In what way?
I went to school a year earlier than the children here in the States. And when I got here, they were like, you're too young for this grade. We've got to hold you back.
Oh, there is that now. Yes.
Yeah.
It's
and
ridiculous.
So they held me back a year. So I got to go through the same year of schooling. and I didn't do very well in American school. I didn't really adjust very well, I would
say. What
was
difficult?
Everything. The disciplinary styles, they don't focus
on certain things. Did you require a lot?
I would believe that I required a lot of not control, but a lot of organization.
Uh-huh.
I required routine, and I required some set of rhythm and semblance of kind of continuity in life. And I didn't have that. I had a home that wasn't exactly the nicest. My mother was a very angry person.
Before the move also?
Before the move also, yes.
So just part of her temperament.
It was part of her temperament. I didn't see her much when we were in South Africa because she was always working. And so we had a nursemaid who took care of us.
What did your mother do?
I believe she worked with computers first when she was very, very young. And then she stayed in the administrative kind of fashion of work.
Mm-hmm.
When we moved to the States, she was hopping about with several different interior design companies, and she was working as an interior design assistant, basically. So she helps you figure out what you want to put in your house.
And the nursemaid who took care of you, what was she like?
Oh my gosh, she was the most amazing. We went through a few. We had three or four, but there was one in particular that I remember very specifically, and she used to baby me all the time, and she was wonderful. And
still alive?
I don't know. I have not since seen or spoken to her since we left. And again, like I said, you know, we lived in a world where if you were a certain race, you were better than other people. And unfortunately, parts of my family also held that to a certain degree, my mother included. Even though my mother didn't like living in that environment, she still harbored some of that mentality where if I'm this person, I'm better than you, I'm above you. And so her temperament kind of got worse, I would say, when we moved to the United States, as far as socially and familiarity. She was very aggressive in life. When we came to the States and everything, it was social shock outside of the home and inside mm-hmm. of the home, mm-hmm. because we were used to a certain way of lifestyle in the home. We hardly mm-hmm. ever saw my mom, and my stepdad was always working. And when we weren't with them, we were with family. So when we were in South Africa, we were constantly hopping about from house to house to house. And at one point in time, we didn't even have a home. We lived with our grandmother for a while. And so I was used to seeing all these other people in my life.
Was there a safety valve in that, being around all these people who cared about you?
Yeah. It was more of a, the kids need to be with somebody safe, and also, I don't want the kids right now, you take them. It was kind of a mixture of both.
Mm-hmm.
In all of that, in moving to the States and everything, our lifestyle changed. So my mom was around more often, and she wasn't used to this. My mm-hmm. mother was never really used to being a mom. And so when the time came that she had to be a mother, it was very difficult for her because she didn't really know how. And she was extremely abusive, unfortunately, and she had a very short fuse. I mean, you leave a dish in the sink and it was the end of the world.
Yeah.
When we attempted to kind of assimilate, I would say, to the American way of lifestyle, the kind of American things like the holidays and Christmas and Thanksgiving mm-hmm. and all of those really true American things, we tried to actually start doing that and mm-hmm. incorporating that into our lifestyles. And for the first year, it went very well. It was very fun and it was a novelty. We had a Christmas and we had holidays mm-hmm. and we had a Thanksgiving. It was really sweet. But then afterwards, the whole family dynamic came back into play. Mm-hmm. And there was one year my mom took our Christmas presents and threw them against the wall.
Oh,
there was another time
terrible.
Where she took the entire meal and just threw it all in the trash.
Oh, so that's severe.
Couldn't eat anything. Oh, she was a very aggressive person.
Uh-huh.
And through all of this, I was going to a new school with new children, with a new mindset and a new social infrastructure. And now I had all this stuff going on at home. And so I was struggling.
Oh, I can see that.
I didn't want to pay attention in school.
Did you have friends?
Wasn't worth it for me. I had a couple of friends, but I was an outsider. I was very strange to a lot of kids, mainly because I had an accent, and I'm weird. I'm a weird kid.
I can't see that. Okay.
I can tell you, I'm a bit of a weirdo. And so I had a few friends starting out, but I still was dealing with the stuff going on at home.
Yep.
And that was the predominant thing in my life, was I didn't want to go home sometimes.
Sure.
Because it wasn't a sanctuary.
Right.
And I dreaded having to do anything revolving around school because my mother would get frustrated. And a lot of the assignments that we have in the American school system, they ask you to involve your parents.
Oh.
And a lot of the time, I wasn't able to involve
her
because she was just so negative towards so many things.
So it sounds like you just got in a place of being isolated in so many ways.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And as
I got older,
I continued to isolate myself even more.
Oh, really?
And so I really became an outcast when I was in high school, into middle school and high school. And I didn't have many friends. I only had a couple. And that it got worse in the home. As I got older, mm-hmm. things got even more intense. And it was sort of like a rolling rock on a mossy hill. It just kept on collecting and And eventually, you know, there were so many different things that happened. There was an incident where I had a school friend call the police on my family because my stepfather found out that I'd run away from home.
Mm-hmm.
And I had written a letter saying, I've run away from home, I'm not coming back, and all this stuff. And I ran, well, I didn't run very far. I ran down the street to a friend's house. And she was scared because he called me and he threatened me.
Oh, so he was difficult also.
Yes, he was difficult also.
Uh-huh. So he never came to your defense here.
No.
Oh.
And he was consumed with a lot of his own personal things, which often happens in these situations where children are suffering from parents who are focusing on themselves and their own internal issues. And then they unfortunately take those internal issues out on their children. And so he threatened me with physical violence, and she called the police as a result. And it wasn't a very positive experience. I had a police officer sit in front of me and show me scars on his arms, telling me that his parents whipped him when he was a child, and I should just deal with it. I should just get over it.
My goodness.
I have a good life. And I was reunited with my very unfortunate mother in Colorado.
This was in this country. Okay, that's just so shocking.
And so I was sent back with her, and it was a very awkward small bit of time because my mother at this point had now known. It was an obvious show that I was unhappy, that I didn't want to be here. And we'd had several other instances where I'd contacted social services, and she'd convinced them that nothing was going on. And so she was well aware that I was attempting to get away.
And so did you have to stay? You stayed there all the way till your adulthood?
I did. Yeah, I stayed. Well, I stayed until I was into my middle teens, around 16 or 17. And around 17 years of age, it was quite funny. My older brother was working at a restaurant. He works in culinary arts. And I told him, I said, look, I don't want to go to school anymore, but if I can't go to school, mom's going to tell me that I need to get a job. So can you help me get a job?
Mm-hmm.
And he helped me get an interview at his workplace. And 17 years old, I got my first job as a hostess, being paid $10 an hour. That is unheard of in the Americas, especially for a 17-year-old kid.
Yeah.
And so I was very excited.
And you got an apartment?
I ended up coming to her and saying, look, I'm leaving school. And she said, if you don't have a job in a week, you're going to be out of this house.
Oh.
And the next week she calls me in the morning. She says, where are you? And I said, I got to go. I'm at work. And she was flabbergasted. She was completely blown away that, you know, she'd laid down this ultimatum and I didn't let it stop me. And from that point on, I decided I don't want to be at home. So I left. And I went to live with a friend in another state.
Oh, cool.
I stayed there for a while, and you know, I still wasn't happy because I didn't know what I wanted to do with my life.
Mm-hmm.
And
what were you good at?
I was very good at interpersonal skills. Very good.
I can see that.
Very good.
And I mean, so, the fact that you're telling this story and you're smiling and you're laughing and you're seeing the something in it that's allowing you to be free to enjoy yourself.
Yeah. And throughout all of these, you know, difficult moments in my life, which they were difficult moments, but I like to think that the challenges are what builds us. They're what makes us stronger. And it's kind of like that cliche saying, what doesn't kill me makes me stronger. At this point, I think I should probably be able to lift up a freaking Buick.
Yes, probably.
But yeah, I moved about for a bit while I was in my teens, and I was trying to find something that I wanted to do. I worked in performance. I worked as a dancer with fire. I did fire dancing. I learned how to do fire dancing.
How did you learn about this? How did you come to this?
It was just some random thing that I'd come across when I went to a little get-together party, and everybody was playing music, and there was a young man there who was fire dancing. It was Maori dancing, and he was actually... his heritage is from the Aboriginals, and his family moved from Australia. So it was really cool that he showed this to me, and I thought, oh, this is really great. You know, I'm a very creative person, and I'm very physical, and it kind of fit really well. And I did that for a bit, and I didn't see it taking me anywhere. So I thought, maybe I should go back into business.
Well, I would guess that would be a hard way to earn a living.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Not a lot of people in the market for fire dancers.
No.
So I went back into the business world, and I worked with retail and did that for a while, and I still wasn't happy. I was making a lot of money.
Good for
you. I was 17, almost 18 years old, and I was pulling in at least $2,000 every couple of weeks. I was doing very well for myself, but I wasn't happy, and I didn't know what I wanted. So I decided then, you know what, I'm going to do the patriotic thing, and I joined the military.
Oh, my goodness.
I turned 18 years old.
I don't get so often taken by surprise.
Oh, yeah. I walked right into the office. I already knew what I wanted, what job I wanted, everything. I just walked in. I said...
Was this Army?
This was the Army. Yeah. I walked into the Army recruitment station, and I said, sign me up. And they were like, well, do you want to, you know, talk about anything? I said, no, just sign me up. I know exactly what I want. I know exactly
what
I want
to do.
And what was that? I chose to be a Seaburn, which full title, get ready for it. Take a deep breath. Chemical, biological, radiological, nuclear specialist with site of ground explosion. So that was my full job title.
And, okay, so that was your job title. Yeah. And may I ask what training you had?
I trained with two different groups.
To say it is hard enough.
Oh, yeah.
How do we learn how to do it?
I trained in Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri.
After you joined?
After I joined, yeah. Uh-huh. They trained me. And what I learned basically was how to decontaminate objects and individuals, how to help people who've been exposed
to chemical
or biological or radiological nuclear explosions or exposure. I was taught how to cordon off areas to keep people safe from going into those areas. So basically, if something bad happened with nuclear or biological or some sort of contamination or hazard, that if you're exposed to, it can harm you. I was the person who got called
in. Is that frequent?
To do damage control.
Is that frequent?
Thankfully, no.
Okay.
Thankfully, no, it's not frequent. Many of my jobs entailed preparing people. Preparation. That was my job. Is I was the person you call in the event of an emergency, but I'm here to tell you what to do in case it happens or to prevent that emergency from happening.
So where did that lead you, this?
Well, it didn't lead me down a very good road, unfortunately. The military was amazing. I really feel bad about my experience and the experiences of other soldiers because the military is such a wonderful thing. It's a fantastic option for people who don't know themselves or what to do with themselves or how they want to apply themselves. It gives a lot of people a sense of organization and rhythm, and it teaches people hierarchy and how to take command and orders and how
earlier that you did need organization and stuff. Uh-huh.
Yeah. And so I loved the lifestyle. I loved having this sense of I know exactly what I need to do, when I need to do it and how to do it because I've been given all of the tools I need. The unfortunate thing is that emotionally and psychologically, I was in the same place that I was when I was a child in my abusive home. And so my mother was replaced by my superiors. And it was very unfortunate because there were so many people who were above me who were just the most phenomenal individuals I'd ever met. They were the best leaders you could ever hope for. They knew what they wanted and needed in life. They knew what their soldiers needed. And they were very caring towards each other. You were a family. And then there were other people who had joined for, you know, reasons that weren't exactly the best.
Oh.
And some of them had joined because they had nothing else that they could do, literally. They legally had no other options, and so they were forced to join the military. And unfortunately, these individuals don't adhere to that lifestyle. They're not used to taking orders, and when they get to give the orders, oh, they love it.
Yes.
And sometimes they'll go way too far. I had sergeants that I had to have removed from authority over me because they were so aggressive and violent and abusive. It was absolutely terrifying. We had some sergeants who were very sexist. We had a lot of individuals who were racist, which made me extremely uncomfortable. And I didn't want to be in this military institution and feeling like I was doing so many good things, and here I am listening to a person assault their fellow soldier because of their race or the city they came from or the job they have. And so it was a very interesting environment to find myself in where I was like, I'm supposed to depend on these people, but I wouldn't even give them the time of day if this was in the civilian world.
Did you? Right. Yes. And in fact, you left that.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I was medically discharged from the military
because
I sustained injuries. And
was that active duty injury?
Yeah, it was an active duty injury.
Where was that?
That was actually here in the States, believe it or not. And it was actually as a result of those individuals that use their rank in a negative manner.
What happened? What was your injury?
I was in a live fire training mission in preparation for Afghanistan, and I jumped out of a vehicle to get to cover during the training mission. And when I landed wrong, and I snapped the tibia, the main bone in your lower leg.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew I'd hurt something, but I didn't know what.
Mm-hmm.
And I continued the mission. I finished everything and came back, and I realized, you know, I'm in a significant amount of pain. And I can't run. This is unusual. I mean, I was very fit. And so I went to our doctor and I said, look, I think something's broken. Can you help me? And his response literally was to throw it back in my face. Tell me that I was being a whiny female.
Oh, because nothing, you
that
didn't
nothing
see a
was
swelling
wrong with
or
me.
Anything.
Yeah, he didn't even look at me. He didn't even give me the time of day. I mean, he didn't even blink twice before telling me to get out of his office. And I kept on trying to get somebody to look at my leg, and it was really on and off, you know. They'd care for me for a couple of weeks, they put me on crutches, and then they'd say, okay, you're done, you're done being lazy now, get back to work. So I re-broke that leg 3 more times.
Oh.
Yeah. I used to wrap it in a splint just so I could pass my physical training tests, which are a PT.
And you're
tests.
Saying it broke 3 more times?
3 more times, yeah.
Under the stress
under
of you're just treating it like normal.
Yeah. And the very last time I was actually on my way to get on the plane to go to Afghanistan. And they had put me on lockdown because of an itinerary delay at first. They had some paperwork issues. And they sent me through this thing called soldier readiness, where they send us to basically get all of our loose ends fixed before we go to deploy.
Mm-hmm.
And I went back and a civilian doctor took one look at me and said, "You're not deploying." And that's when crap hit the fan. My entire unit thought that I was trying to get out of my duties. There were people who didn't believe I was injured. There were other people who were absolutely just completely dismissive. And then there were other people who were very caring, but they didn't have any power to do
anything. But you were still in pain.
I was still in a massive amount of pain. And at this point in time, I was using crutches to walk everywhere. I couldn't walk unassisted. And I was medically honorably discharged. Unfortunately, the way that the military goes about things is they don't offer you any help. They say they do, but they really don't. I was not offered any resources.
You mean to fix your
to
injury?
Fix my life, to get on, to transition. And I believe that they're making efforts now to make it better for soldiers who are transitioning both out of active duty and out of combat duty. So I hope that it's changed, because it's been a while since my situation and my wonderful dealings with the military. But they discharged me on a medical discharge, which means that I had a disability. And they claimed that there's a percentage, it goes from 1 to 100. They claimed that I was only 10% disabled. They said that I had shin splints, which are tiny little fractures that runners get.
Yes.
And I thought, this is crazy. I'm on crutches. I can't walk. There's no way I've only got shin splints. Something's really wrong.
How did you finally get to somebody who took it seriously?
I went through the Veterans Affairs Association, and they're basically the handoff. They hand you off to the VA after you leave the military. And I went to the VA, and even the VA was very dismissive with me. And I worked with them and worked with them, and I finally got my disability raised, you know, my percentage raised, which allowed me to receive more medical benefits and more assistance, which was very helpful for me. But what wasn't helpful was when I came into these doctors and I said, look, you know, my leg's been bothering me, and it's been bothering me since I got out. It's the reason I got out, and it's getting worse. And they go, oh, well, it says here you've only got shin splints, so you're fine.
Oh, that's horrible.
And so for about a year and a half, I was ignored, and I went very quickly from crutches to wheelchair use. I was a full-time wheelchair user. Both my legs basically shut down.
I have a question.
Yeah.
It must be some doctor who put you in the wheelchair.
Yeah.
You don't just go to a department.
The Veterans Affairs, yeah.
So if they're putting you in a wheelchair, isn't that acknowledgement that there's...
It's a bit silly, right?
It doesn't make any sense at
all.
It
doesn't, does it?
No.
And I went to them and I said...
That sounds like such negligence.
Yeah. I said, look, I'm still having trouble walking. Oh, here's a wheelchair. And at first they gave me a standard hospital wheelchair, and it was just too cumbersome. I lived in a house that was not handicap accessible. I had 16 stairs in my home. I lived in Alaska.
Oh.
And so I came back and I said, this isn't working. They said, oh, here's a better wheelchair. So they gave me a better wheelchair. And after a while, I'd had enough, and I'd been visiting doctor after doctor after doctor.
Nobody said, let's take an x-ray?
Finally, somebody looked at my leg. And it was a physician's assistant. And the first thing he said was, I know exactly what's going on with you. He said, you damaged your leg so much so, he says, I believe that you have now developed a neurological disease. And I said, what are you talking about? He goes, well, I treat some patients, and I have a young patient who's 14 years old who has this issue, and it's called RSD. And I was like, oh my goodness, what's going on now? And so we did a bit of research together, and I found out that, yes, indeed, I developed this disorder where basically you suffer some form of nerve damage or other injury that's either repetitive or so intense that it results in your body changing the way that it feels pain.
Oh.
And so now...
So you weren't feeling for pain really
I wasn't feeling too right. The pain was completely disproportionate.
Mm-hmm.
And it was always constant. It was always ongoing. It literally felt like my foot was in a bear trap all the time. And it was traveling up.
Well, the injury was trying to let you know something.
Yeah. And so he said, go home and research the treatment options. And so I did, and we found it's an incurable disease. It's incurable, and it progresses as well. So it will get worse, and it's continually getting worse now. And it causes muscle spasms, it causes muscle contractions.
So what was the solution to this?
Well, I came back to him and I said, look, my leg is damaged and it's changing colors. It's turning black and blue. I would like you to remove it, to amputate it.
Oh, that was your decision?
That was my decision. And the very minute I chose to speak to them on amputation, their heads exploded. They were so terrified because amputation is considered a last resort procedure. And for them, they had not pushed all of the options. But for me, looking at the options...
Doesn't sound like they pushed any of them.
They didn't push any of them at first. But they wanted now to focus on all these different options that were laid before me. But the options were barbaric. I mean, they wanted to put a box inside my body with a tube that runs up my spine.
Oh.
And whenever pain is sensed, it literally pumps pain medication directly into me.
So it's a total masking procedure.
Yeah. Every single option was a masking option.
So how did you get them to take your amputation request?
I forced them. Literally. I forced them. In every sense of the word. I forced them to amputate. And the most hilarious part about it was when I got to the VA and was in the process of trying to get them to amputate, I had a doctor come in and said, there's nobody in this hospital who's willing to do this for you. I said, I don't care if you find me a chainsaw monkey. You do it. You. I don't care if it's an orangutan with a hatchet. You find me somebody who has at least the dexterity to hold a tool and remove this limb.
And an anesthesiologist.
No. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
And he again said no. And I said, listen, man, I'm a fly fisherman in Alaska. If you don't do it, I'll go catch a salmon, tie it to my foot, and I'll let the bears do it for me. And I was just so desperate.
So how did somebody finally come to your aid here?
Finally, it was absolutely hilarious. TRICARE, an Air Force administrator of the hospital I was in, got a hold of my file and decided this isn't happening. He transferred me to a civilian hospital, and the very next morning after being transitioned, the doctor walked in and said, we're doing the procedure tomorrow. And it was amazing. It was life-changing. The next morning, I woke up from the procedure, and remember, both my legs had shut down.
Yes.
And both my legs were very atrophied.
Yes.
And it was like a Kill Bill moment when I woke up and I looked down and was like, wiggle your big toe. And I could move my right foot again.
Oh, my goodness.
And it was like, it was almost as if somebody had hit a reset button. Yeah. After removing that damaged limb and all of the craziness that was going on there, my body was like, oh, it's finally done. And for the first time ever, I was not in pain. And I could feel my limbs again. And I could feel heat and sensation. And I could move. And my foot no longer dropped. And the staff was astonished because they had put a walker in the room for another patient that had left. And I grabbed the walker and I was walking about. And the nurse came in.
Between the one leg and the walker.
And she was blown away. She was like, oh my gosh, you know, you came in here in a wheelchair and now you're in a walker. They were so excited. And the hospital staff was absolutely amazing. They were so caring.
So that was really the start of your...
It was the start
back to the living.
Of a new life. It was a whole new chapter. It was like I had started a whole new book. And the most amazing thing about that whole transition was it was not only a transition physically for me as a person with different abilities and different lifestyle. Uh-huh. It was also kind of a great way to, it was a great thing that happened to me. And a lot of people go, well, amputation was a great thing that happened. And I say, yeah, because it finally gave me the strength not only to stand up for myself, but to stand up for what I felt was right. And in the middle of this, I had my family on one side and I had my military family on the other side. And I had to make a choice and basically decide, you know, is it worth it? Is it worth it keeping these people in my life? Are these people really worthy of me? Now that I have fought to keep myself alive, are they worthy to be in this life? And at the time of my amputation, I was still in contact with my mother and I was desperately trying to build a relationship with her. And when I told her I'm getting the amputation, she blew up. She thought it was stupid. She reacted as if I was asking her to chop off her foot. And she immediately demonized me and told me that I was looking for attention, that I was, you know, doing all this stuff. And it finally came to a point where I said, you know what? I'm cutting off the foot. I need to cut off a few more things. And so I told her, I said, this does not mean I don't love you. I said, but what you need to understand is you are not my mother. You have never been my mother. And we have never had a relationship. And no matter how many times I've tried to have a relationship with you and build some sort of rapport with you and something happens in my life, it's almost as if, you know, I'm a punching bag to you. And if I can't be a punching bag, well, I can't be anything.
What did she say?
She was devastated. She was absolutely devastated. She exploded with hatred and anger and accused me of being very loathsome and disdainfully, you know, towards her. And it was something out of love that I had done. And I told her, I said, listen, you know, I don't know if we can ever have a relationship in the future. I said, but if you want a relationship with me, you must work on yourself. You must fix yourself.
You are one of the most courageous people I have ever met in my life.
But I told this to her, I said, you have to fix yourself. You have to find out why you are so angry and why you are so hurt. And you have to remedy yourself before I can let you in my life again.
Has she done that?
Because you're toxic. She has not.
Oh.
And it's unfortunate, too, because now that I'm getting my life going, my career has started, I'm starting to find my place in the world and figuring out what I want to do. And it's these people who previously wanted to break you down so much who now come crawling out of the woodworks you start reaching and attaining success. And it was just recently that I had a television show. I played a character called Madison on Graceland on USA. And after my first episode came out, it wasn't even surprising. I was actually expecting it. But she had her boyfriend, who he's her middleman that she uses. And she had her boyfriend call me and message me and email me on several different platforms the same message.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, oh my gosh, we're so proud of you. We saw your television show. You did such an amazing job. And then at the very end, he says, you should really talk to your mother. She misses you. She wants to be in your life. And all I did was just, I didn't even open some of the messages. I just very quietly just put them away.
So where are you with her now?
I don't talk to her at all.
Uh-huh.
She is non-existent in my life at all. And it's unfortunate, I would say, for her, because she so desires being in control and being involved, that she wants that presence, but she doesn't know how to be a mother, and she doesn't know that she didn't have that presence to begin with, and so there's no foundation that she can start building from. And I don't know if there'll ever be a foundation, because like I said, the only time that I would be willing to even revisit is if I feel as though she's reached a certain level of self-actualization, which she hasn't.
Does she know that that is the only time you will think
I mean, I expressed it to her very clearly. And, you know, she's had moments where she's had contact with me before, but because of issues like recently I had to renew my residency and I needed information. And she held that information hostage from me in order to try and get me to communicate with her more. And so every time I would try to get this information from her, she would switch gears and she would try to talk about my life and what's going on with me and the, you know, events in her life and this is going on and this is going on. And I'd have to pull her back and go, I'm sorry, I'm not here to talk about that. All I need from you is this information. And eventually I had to shut her down and say, you're not giving me what I need and this needs to stop. You need to stop calling me. And I contacted my stepfather and he gave me the information that I needed. Within 5 seconds, I might add. It was very quick. And it was right after getting that information that she did not understand exactly what I meant when I said what I said to her. And I received voicemail after voicemail for about 30 minutes afterwards from her that were just a range of emotions. Screaming at the top of her lungs. Next one, she was sobbing. It was like a stalker, you know, calling you and, please, I love you. Please pay attention to me. And it was quite, it was very eye-opening for me to see the aggressiveness and the sheer just determination she has where she wants to inject herself into your space. And like I said, I don't know if there'll ever be a moment in the future, mm-hmm. but she's going to have to work very, very hard, not on our relationship, but on herself.
Yes, yes.
Because you truly can't have a relationship with other people unless you know who you are and what you want in life. Because then you end up dragging other people down because you're trying to figure out who you are, and they might try to figure out who they are too, you know?
It's wonderful. Just listening to you is so wonderful. So, you know, I throughout this conversation, because I just want to switch to the love letter aspect for a minute. I could hear about six of them in here that I would want to write.
Oh.
And one, of course, is to the nursemaid.
Oh, yes.
Who took care of you.
Oh, yes.
Have you ever thought of that?
I have. She's one of the defining people in my childhood memories.
I mean, if she's still alive.
If she's still alive, I would...
Did she have children?
I believe she had one daughter.
Wouldn't it be something to find if she's alive?
My gosh.
If you would write to her, I will tell you that is the letter they will find in her hand the day she passes.
Oh, that would be amazing.
And if she's not, just to catch her up onto where you are.
Yeah.
And to thank her for what she gave you, and that's up to you to specify.
Oh, yeah.
And if she's not, if you could find her grown child.
That would be lovely, too.
And to be able to say, what was her name, the nursemaid?
I wish I could remember.
Oh, really?
I wish I could
remember.
There were so many different nursemaids that we had that the names just never...
Well, if you could find, I mean, it's an investigation.
Yeah.
That you'd have to do.
Uh-huh.
But to write to this child.
Oh, my gosh.
And say...
And tell her, you know, just how much her mother means to me.
Yes.
Because I remember her face and I remember her voice specifically.
So how could you find her?
I remember the way that she felt when she held me. It's those things that you remember a mother supposed
that's
to
right.
be doing.
And so how would you be able to find her?
I'm not sure how I'd be able to find her. I mean, I think that the only way that I probably could would be to get into contact with, you know, my stepfather and see if maybe he has an idea.
Oh, sure, because you've still got people. Well, if you ever had time for this.
Oh, I
or the emotional energy, and on the subject of emotional energy, you seem to be limitless.
Sometimes I don't think so.
Well, but anyway, if ever, it's just a thought.
Yeah.
And the other one, of course, is to your mother.
Yes.
If you ever had the, whatever it would take.
Yeah.
To write a letter of something.
Yeah.
Something.
And the letter that I
wishing,
would probably,
wishing her well.
Yeah, the
on
letter
her
I would write to her is would be full of nothing but hope for her.
That's what
to reach who she wants to be as a person. Because I know, you know, and I've seen it growing up, and it was very, very predominant in her behavior. She didn't know who she wanted to be. She didn't know where she wanted to be.
That would be quite an act of.
And that would be the love letter that I wrote to her.
Oh, maybe someday
that
you'll
she
do
hopes
that.
To find herself. Okay. Or that I hope that she finds the happiness that she's been really, really desperately seeking.
Okay. Maybe you'll do that.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm so glad that that's like in there.
Yeah.
As a possibility.
Definitely.
Okay. I want to thank you for doing this with me. I've just.
Yeah. Thank you for having me.
I've learned so much in the last half hour with you. My goodness. Well, thank you, dear. And maybe sometime you'll come back and talk about more. Yes, well, because
that's, a long one.
That's right. I can tell it is. And there's your career and what you're doing now and your discovery.
Yeah.
So will you come back sometime?
Definitely, yes.
Perfect. Okay, so I'm not saying goodbye to you.
No.
But to our listeners, I am saying goodbye for now. And please remember that if you think you need to wait for a special occasion to write a love letter, writing a love letter really is a special occasion.
It is.
And you deserve that for yourself.
Yeah.
And there's always a reason. Okay. So until next time, thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye.